Make Me Smart is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million.
With the launch of ChatGPT, Sam Altman and OpenAI reinvigorated our imaginations and fears of a world with artificial intelligence. While the company looked like a stunning success from the outside, a battle was brewing within on what the future of AI should be. Almost a year after launching ChatGPT, that battle erupted into a war when the company fired its charismatic CEO, Sam Altman. From Wondery, Business Wars is a podcast about the biggest corporate rivalries of all time. And in the newest season, host David Brown digs into the philosophical differences within OpenAI that culminated in Sam Altman's shocking firing, the chaos that followed, and what it means for the future and safety of AI in the modern world. Follow Business Wars on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus. And for more deep dive and daily business content, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more, Wondery means business.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.
All right. Andiamo, eh?
Andiamo.
Andiamo, eh? I'm part Italian, yeah.
I did not know. Really?
I am.
How much?
I mostly call out the Norwegian stuff, but it's a little
Italian. I know.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyway,
dear everyone, I'm Molly Wood. Welcome to Make Me Smart, where we just learned that Kai Rizdahl is a little Italian.
Oh, my goodness. I'm a little bit Italian. The name my grandfather was born with was Giuseppe Picciocchi.
Really?
Yeah.
I love that.
Yeah.
What a delightful name. Huh.
There we
See?
Go. Anyway.
Making you smart already.
Yeah. Smart already. So, look, it's Thursday. We're here. We got some news. We're going to make you smile, and then we'll be out of your hair in 15 minutes. Bang, zoom. What do we think?
That's the plan. That's the plan.
All right.
I mean, I've loaded this sucker up with links, but we'll do
what
we'll do.
So there is like breaking news. Like as we go to tape, this just happened, right?
Yeah. Literally, Congress has just passed the $484 billion bill that has money for small businesses as well as hospitals and, hallelujah, testing.
Yeah.
So there's that. We just got this, and I know you guys are going to hear this a little later, but we just got this news alert as we were coming to sit in front of the microphones. The president has not yet signed it, but has indicated that'll happen.
But here's the thing: it's not going to be enough, and so we're going to do this again in like 10 days, 2 weeks, with a much bigger number.
I mean, I'm ready to.
Yes.
Yeah. It's like, are we going to take bets on how long that actual fund lasts? I mean, from what I'm hearing from the fintech industry, like.
Yeah.
People are locked and loaded to start just hitting this thing hard, this website hard.
I'll tell you what, I think the over-under on this thing is 12 days, truly. Again, because it's a smaller amount of money, the need is still there, the demand is still there, and I think 12 days is not an unreasonable number to say, yep, it's going in that period of time.
That is oddly specific and kind of long-sounding, to be honest. So I would have gone fewer. I would have gone like five. No. But I guess we'll see.
Yes.
Because.
Okay.
And they're off, basically. All right. What else
yeah,
you got?
Yeah, yeah. Okay. So I got two things. And I know I'm breaking the rules here, but God darn it. Sometimes you just gotta. Sometimes you just gotta. So look, a couple of things. And let's go to the other part of this rescue package that the federal government has been working on. Because let's think of it all as one big package, right? You got Congress and the White House and fiscal policymakers. You also have, as we've talked about before on this pod and certainly on Make Me Smart on the Tuesday Big Show, you've got monetary policymakers, by which I mean the Federal Reserve, and it has on its own accord been plowing trillions of dollars of liquidity into the financial system. And if you remember back in 2008, one of the big complaints about what happened back then was that Ben Bernanke and the gang were just going, here, banks, have a gazillion dollars. And there was not a whole lot of transparency. Jay Powell has learned the lessons of 2008 in two regards. Number one is go big, go early, right, which he is doing, and which he learned from Ben Bernanke. The other is transparency matters, and that is because of the unrest that came out of that bailout package back 10 years ago. Tea Party, Occupy Wall Street, all that stuff, right? So the Fed announced today, Thursday, that it's going to every single month reveals, and this is the quote, substantial amounts of information on its emergency lending facilities and who's getting the money. It's going to talk about the names of participants, how much they borrowed, how much they're paying for the money, what the interest rate was, and what the overall costs and fees and revenue are for each lending facility. Remember, the Fed does these things called facilities. They're often really confusing acronyms, but that's what they're called. Anyway, so the Fed's going to be really transparent about this, and I think this is a good sign. Props to Jay Powell.
That is outstanding and hopefully will be emulated with respect to the 500 or 400 and some billion dollar bailout fund in the CARES Act as well.
Well, yes, this is not ideally that would be the case.
I mean, that was
except as
we talked about how that was a huge part of that fight.
We did. But also the president has fired the guy who was going to be the inspector general for a big part of that bailout. And anyway, so I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, though, that's exactly why this should create that pressure, because the president did fire the person whose job it was to oversee the spending of those bailout funds. Boy, it's going to be fascinating as that starts to come out, because there's so much anger already, too, about where Small Business Administration loans went. And Well, I like it. Good job, Jay Powell. I'm with you.
Okay. Good job, Jay Powell.
What's
so there
number
we go.
Two?
Very quick on my second item. It's from Mohammed El Aryan, who used to be at PIMCO. He's a talented and skilled observer of this economy. And he said on Bloomberg TV today, talking about the markets, he said, and this is the quote, there is massive cognitive failure in markets processing the extent of the damage to the global economy. And look, as we have said countless times, it's... First of all, the stock market is not the economy, right? But the stock market was disconnected from the real economy going into this crisis. And now, as we have seen, as we bounce around 23,000 on the Dow, it is disconnected from the gravity of the situation. And I just, this RT is an endorsement for what Mohammed El Aryan said. Massive cognitive failure on the part of the markets to realize what is happening.
I have a question
about
this, actually, because I did see this morning when you retweeted it. And I read that big Guardian long read about the moves that the central bankers took, that the Fed and European central bankers took to shore up credit markets. And this is what I was wondering about, what seems to be a large cognitive disconnect with respect to the markets. It seems that some of their exuberance is related to the Fed's moves, like the fact that business is not going to have a lack of credit and destructive financial conditions that would cause them to fail en masse and not have access to credit. So is there a somewhat counterintuitive argument that since the stock market is not the economy, but it does represent a whole bunch of big public businesses that we sort of need to be well capitalized if people are going to be employed, wouldn't it be like way worse if the stock market was also totally tanking and there was no capital publicly or debt-wise available?
Yes, absolutely, for sure. And there's a lot that goes along with that, right? It's the wealth effect. It's, I mean, there's a whole bunch of stuff that goes along with that. Totally, totally, yes, I agree with that. But on a day like today, when we learned another 4 million people had lost their jobs in the last 7 days and the stock market basically ended the day flat instead of cratering, how does that make sense?
But wouldn't that just be feelings? Don't we want the stock market to not have feelings, ideally?
Well, no, that's not feelings. That's data. 4.2 million people, their jobs evaporated. How are they going to pay their rent? Rent is due in like 10 days.
Oh, no, I get that. Believe me, I have a lot of feelings about it, for sure.
I know you,
but I guess
I know,
what
I know
I'm saying
do.
Is like, I guess what I'm saying is I kind of want the stock market to stay strong.
Well, of course we do. Of course we do. But the signals that the market is giving, right, of its extreme volatility, but also the fact that it hasn't actually retested those lows that we saw, it feels like forever, but 3 weeks ago, is a sign that maybe they're not quite processing, as Muhammad Al-Aryan said, in a really smart kind of way.
So the fear, so the ideal scenario would be that they're like, we feel comfortable, we have access to capital, we can acquire the debt that we need to keep our businesses going, and that will be good for the few employees who apparently remain.
Right.
But the fear is that if they actually have not internalized it, or it's worse than they think it is, that the crash is going to be worse?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I think that's what he is saying, right? In the long run, there will be a crash. We have not refound those bottoms. Yeah.
Yeah. All right. My turn. I sort of want to apologize because the other day I snapped at you and
you
said
did?
You were whataboutting me with respect to Facebook taking down content.
No, that was a good conversation.
It was a good question to ask too about these sites and taking down content and when they should do it and whether it's a good thing. And I have a follow-up on that, which is that The Markup, which is a tech news site, did a little bit of testing of Facebook's advertising system. So companies, these social media companies have gotten a lot of credit for taking down and trying to take down and trying to aggressively combat misinformation in ways that they never have before. But The Markup pointed out that when it comes to advertising, there's actually like a way, there would be a way easier way for Facebook and even Twitter and any other company that offers targeted advertising to take down misinformation. And that would be to not allow targeting on the basis of categories such as pseudoscience.
So the markup
wrote about how it paid, the site paid to advertise a post targeted to people interested in pseudoscience. Because Facebook, for those who don't know, has what is basically a self-serve advertising system. And if you ever want to get the shock of your life, go and try to buy an ad on Facebook and look at all the things that you can target it to. They've already been sued over this under like fair housing laws because you could literally exclude people of color, women, certain zip codes from like housing ads. And they would up to this minute, up to just maybe a day or two ago when they finally took this category down, target 78 million people who algorithmically have been identified as interested in pseudoscience with articles about taking a bath in bleach and that kind of thing. And so there's been this argument all along that if these social media platforms want to be serious about misinformation on their platform, they kind of have to start there. Like you can't just start with advertising and then you can do a lot less censorship, frankly.
Yep.
You still have to do some of that. I mean, there's still plenty of misinformation circulating on Facebook. But this particular thing, the ad portal, is just like, it's just an invisible menace. And the targeting can be so precise and so scary. And it just riles people up. And frankly, it is something that political candidates, especially like the Trump campaign, is a wizard at this. They are wizards at this. It's how they got all the attention that they did in the 2016 run-up and continue to. But it just, I felt like this just illustrated the fact that you can just buy your way right into people's brains with all the crazy that you want to.
Right. And the risk here, of course, is that it kills people.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
The risk is pretty straightforward. Yes.
Right.
Yeah, in this case, people die.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. So.
All right.
My news story today. But on the plus side, pseudoscience is gone. We don't know what else is out there. Well, that one's gone.
All right. All right. If I were producing this podcast, I would hit the happy place. Right.
Would you like a smile? There we go.
I'm going first because I love
this.
And this is the benefit of real-time slackage as we're doing this podcast. So I had a make me smile thing, but now I've got a better one. Friday, we were talking about, and I revealed my ignorance as to the priestly ways. Specifically, I wasn't, and I said this out loud, I wasn't sure if priests were allowed to drink, and I don't even know how we got on that conversation. Turns out, yes, they are. But now we have in real-time validation from a beer-drinking priest. Here you go. This is from Friar Paul. Just listen to the Friday podcast, great as usual. As to the priest question, I'm a priest of the Franciscan variety, and I've attached a picture of me with a fine Dogfish Head 90-minute IPA. It's lovely. Yes, Friar Paul, Dogfish Head 90s are indeed lovely. I feel so much better now.
Oh, my goodness. This is like the greatest thing.
You got to check out
this show. Really gets results.
Like
his,
He's like in his robe.
He's
and everything,
just a
right? It's cool.
He's in his Franciscan robe, and behind him is a, like this really lovely painting of the Virgin Mary, and he's got his beer.
Right.
That is outstanding. I'm sure our show gets results. That's all I'm saying.
It does. It absolutely does. Oh, man.
And in the real-time Slackage group, they report that the photo will be published, which is awesome.
Oh, good. That's awesome. I think he's my new favorite listener. That's all I'm saying.
I think so, too. Yeah. My Make Me Smell is a little random, but I was watching a clip today of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. And I haven't really been watching. I keep saying, I'm going to watch these late night shows and see how they're all doing it from their basement and whatever. And I haven't because they're late. But I was watching this clip of The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. And, you know, he's like on Zoom with the show's musicians and doing all the interviews that way. But in the opening monologue, he talks about how he's like in his house and he's got his son on one side and his wife on the other side. And they're basically just all hanging out. Doing this show together. And Jimmy Fallon has had his daughters on The Tonight Show a whole bunch. And it just was a little bit delightful. Like, there's a time when everybody would have gone to the office for 15 hours and had, you know, and then the son would have been like, my dad's famous, but I never hang out with him. I don't know. I'm assuming.
Right.
And I have heard that Colbert is like a lot. And so maybe it's hard to have him at home all the time. But it just seemed, frankly, a little bit sweet.
I have told my 12-year-old, oh wait, she's 13 now. I have told my 13-year-old, because when I first set up shop here in the spare room next to my garage, she said, oh, can I be on the show? And I was like, no, you can't be on the show, which of course makes me the worst dad in the world compared to Stephen Colbert, I suppose, but whatever.
Jimmy Fallon, anyway. Yeah. It's not too late. I'm just saying, I think this is going to be a while.
Oh, no.
So...
Oh,
you've still got time. Then I went down a little bit of a rabbit hole about the Invisible Wives. Like, why did Rita Wilson just have to hold Tom Hanks' camera for the Saturday Night Live? And why did the wives all have to be invisible? And Jimmy Fallon's wife is like this super mega producer who's like holding his camera for the Tonight Show. But she's probably doing super mega producing on the side.
Yeah.
But I'm afraid. So it made me smile, but it also made me go, boy, all these late night hosts are dudes with the Invisible Wives.
For sure.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah.
Except, yeah.
Couldn't be more noticeable in a time like this. And then finally, I'm going to do a shameless plug for tomorrow's tech show because I did a whole long thing about David Foster Wallace and how in Infinite Jest in 1996, he has this little aside that may shock you if you've read the book about a rise and fall of video, phone-based video conferencing in the book's timeline. It could not be more relevant to our times. And I had so much fun with it on the Marketplace Tech Podcast. And I hope you will go listen because
we will, of course, listen. 4:47 tomorrow morning. I will be awake.
You got to listen to the podcast. It's only
got to do the long one. All right. We'll do the podcast. All right.
Yep.
Okay.
It's podcast exclusive. It's a good Friday show. And I think if you're like me and you can't stand your own freaking face on Zoom anymore, you're going to love it.
Yeah. I've decided I'm going to turn off my camera, by the way.
Yeah. Totally. Yeah. That's why you're going to feel so validated after you hear this.
For sure. Yep. Yep. All right.
That's it. We are a minute over. We have got to go.
Oh, my God.
I know. But you know this already. There's more on the smart speakers. Today, I'll be on talking about N95 masks.
Oh, I actually have some questions. All right. I will listen. In the meanwhile, of course, the saying is none of us is as smart as all of us. Send us your questions. Subject line, of course, has to be questions. Emails, voice memos, take your pick. makemesmart@marketplace.org.
And get your drink recipes ready because tomorrow's happy hour. Can't even wait. Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner. Our senior producer is Jody Becker. Ben Hethcote produces video with the help of our intern, Ethan Peretz. All of them are combing through the email constantly. Erica Phillips writes our newsletter and our smart speaker explainers.
Speaking of Ethan Peretz, he's the guy who put Fire Paul on the Slack. We're going to have a picture of him with his beer on the episode page at makemesmart.org, so check him out. Today's program was engineered by Ben Talladay. Theme music was composed by Ben and Daniel Ramirez. The executive director of On Demand is Sitar Nieves. Senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark. She has still not gotten on me for Tuesday when I cut her out of the credits. I'm just saying.
I know, and she almost got the hook just now because the music ran out.
I thought about it, but then I was like, don't poke the bear, guy. Don't poke the bear.
Maybe she's run out of time for our shenanigans.
I'm Tanya Mosley. In 1987, my sister Anita vanished without a trace. Decades later, thanks to DNA, we found her. But that's only the beginning of the story. She Has a Name is a new audio documentary that explores the search for redemption, confronting trauma, and healing in the face of unimaginable loss. Subscribe now to Truth Be Told Presents She Has a Name, where every revelation brings us closer to the truth.